From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, offering exhibits and programs about life and history in the Arkansas Ozarks. Located in downtown Springdale, Shiloh is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Admission is free. 750-8165 or shilohmuseum.org for more information.
Still on the Hill will perform songs from Once a River, story songs about the Beaver Lake watershed, June 28th at 7 p.m. at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale. Still on the Hill will give away 100 CDs at this free community performance on a first-come, first-served basis. More information available at stillonthehill.com.
Ahead on Ozarks, a business degree from the University of Arkansas without ever seeing Old Main or setting foot on Senior Walk. An online degree is now a reality.
And Christina Karnatz gives us an update on the updating of Cane Hill. The Washington County community is one of the oldest in the region.
First, Republican gubernatorial hopeful Asa Hutchinson isn't saying whether he'd support Arkansas's private option, but speaking to the Delta Grassroots Caucus last week, he did offer some praise.
What have we learned with the private option? 150,000 people have gained health care. It's certainly been good for our rural hospitals. They've reduced the indigent care, unreimbursed indigent care. But we've also learned some things that I've learned in the campaign trail. We have shifted charitable care to government care.
Hutchinson also says he would have to wait and see if the health care policy has created an incentive for people not to work and if costs outgrow projections. His opponent, Democrat Mike Ross, made no qualms about his stance.
Well, I've not danced around it, and I'll be very clear with you. I would have voted for it, I would have signed it, and as governor, I'll protect funding for the Medicaid expansion, the so-called private option here in Arkansas.
While Hutchinson opposes the Affordable Care Act, he says the private option has conservative principles in it. He also suggests it might be unfair to take away insurance from the working poor, while the federal law gives subsidies to those making more than them.
A public input meeting will be held in Harrison tonight regarding a potential ban on further confined animal feeding operations from being built near the Buffalo National River. Robert Cross is an emeritus professor of chemical engineering at the University of Arkansas and also the president of the Ozark Society. He says the proposed third-party rulemaking change would ban medium and large-scale swine facilities in the Buffalo River watershed. He says some small hog farms would be allowed under the proposed ban.
Depends on the size of the hogs, but if we talk about what's called large hogs, hogs over 50 pounds, it would be that hogs above 750, in other words, 750 hogs above 50 pounds, above that size and number, there could be no further hog farms in the Buffalo River watershed.
Cross says several interested parties petitioned the Arkansas Pollution Control and Ecology Commission to consider the proposed ban on CAFOs in the watershed, and public input meetings are just one step in the process for a proposed ban.
How it works is the commission has to accept the petition, which they did in this case back in April, and then there is a relatively long procedure involving public comment and this, for example, this public meeting. And then they consider it further. There will be comments from the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. It will also be reviewed by the Arkansas Legislative Council. And then finally, sometime next fall, it will be voted on by the commission whether or not it will be accepted or not.
The public input meeting begins tonight in the Duran Conference Center of the North Arkansas Community College on Main Street in Harrison. Those unable to attend the public input meeting will be able to file written comments with the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality through July 1st.
The Fort Smith Board of Directors tonight will consider approval for construction of a proposed fire training facility in the city. Mike Richards, Fort Smith Fire Chief, says the primary goal of the facility is to have a place where firefighters can conduct live fire training.
This particular building will have two levels where we can do live fire training, where we can simulate if we start at the ground level and have a fire at the ground level, or you could start at the ground level and have a fire above you in, say, for example, a second story. Or if you wanted to stage at the second story and simulate that you had a fire below you, like in the basement. You could start up high and then work your way down into a basement area. We don't have anything here in Western Arkansas that provides us the opportunity to do any live fire training.
Chief Richards says currently Fort Smith firefighters have to drive either to facilities in Lincoln or in Camden for equivalent training. Construction of the first phase of the facility, which will be built on property next to the Fort Smith Sanitation Department, will have considerable cost.
The first phase will be $1.176 million. The good thing about this is we're using some Act 833 funding that we have accumulated, that we've been saving up actually over the last 3 or 4 years, not to mention we're going to use a portion of the 1/8 cent sales tax that went to fire department operations that the citizens voted for in March of 2012. That's going to be a one-time cost. So we're going to be able to build this facility, if the board approves it, without using any money from the general fund to do this.
Chief Richards says once phase one of the project is approved by the city, construction will take about 8 months to complete.
Lane closures associated with construction of the Don Tyson Parkway and I-49 interchange in Springdale will last longer than originally anticipated because of recent rains. According to the city of Springdale, the closures of one lane each on the northbound and southbound lanes between exit 69 and 72 of the interstate were expected to end this week, but they'll now last through July 2nd. The lane closures will be only in effect from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. each day, though the shoulders will be closed and lane widths reduced during daytime hours as well.
The city of Bentonville is launching a new geographic information system, or GIS, website today. The new system is at a new URL, so users of the service will need to update their bookmarks. The new GIS site will run on all desktop and mobile internet browsers. City officials say the service is more accessible to all users.
Arkansas Tech University in Ozark is receiving national accreditation for its collision repair technology program. The accreditation was granted by the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, or ASC. That's a nonprofit organization that accredits automotive training programs and tests and certifies repair technicians. ATU Ozark offers a technical certificate in collision repair technology and an associate of applied science in general technology with an option in collision repair technology.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals record gets the professional equivalent of a do-over tonight. When the Nats host the Arkansas Travelers tonight, it will be the start of the second half of the season. The Nats ended the first half of the year last night with an 8-0 shutout of the Travelers and a 25-45 record. Tonight, they'll start the second half with a brand new 0-0 record. First pitch tonight is scheduled for 7:05.
Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the lower 70s. Sunshine tomorrow, highs will be from the upper 80s to lower 90s. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy, lows in the lower 70s.
This is Ozarks at Large. Post-secondary enrollment in distance education courses, especially those offered online, is on the rise. According to a 2011 report from the National Center for Education Statistics, the percentage of undergraduates who took any distance education courses rose from 16% in 2003 to 2004 to 20% in 2007 to 2008. According to an NCES report released earlier this month, 16,702 Arkansas students were enrolled exclusively in distance education courses in the fall of 2012. During the upcoming fall semester, the University of Arkansas will begin offering its first start-to-finish online bachelor's degree program, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. This program is an addition to the approximately 350 unique courses and 29 degree, licensure, and certificate programs offered online by the U of A. Gary Ferrier, Associate Dean for Undergraduate Programs in the Sam M. Walton College of Business, says from conception to approval, creating the four-year online program took almost 2 years. Ferrier says the university created this specific program for a number of reasons.
Online bachelor's in business is the most popular online degree in the U.S., so there's a big market for it. Second, the reputation of the Walton College is one that we would like to leverage and expand upon and be able to reach out to people in other parts of the state who might not be able to come here. For people who are working but need a bachelor's degree to move up in their company and to reach out into the region and hopefully beyond.
Although it is an option, not all students enrolled in distance education are taking all of their courses online. Javier Reyes, Vice Provost for Distance Education, says the university has more than 4,000 students taking at least one online course. Citing fall 2013 numbers, he says around 1,200 students are taking only online courses. Reyes says tuition for online and on-campus courses are the same, but the fees students pay differ. Students enrolled in only online courses, for example, don't have to pay fees that would give them access to the health center on the university's Fayetteville campus. However, Ferrier says, the cost for online courses would include fees that pay for certain educational services.
You do have access to the library, to the Enhanced Learning Center, to the Career Center, and all those student services that are part of the learning process.
So when you think about those, it would be the Center for Educational Access. When we talk about students with disabilities, we're thinking of the Enhanced Learning Center, which would be tutoring, the Quality Writing Center, the library. Those are, they get access to all of those.
While students could make the trip to campus to use these services, they are accessible online. The university offers self-paced courses as well as more traditional courses that have firm deadlines for assignments and tests. Ferrier says exams, which can be taken online, are proctored by a company called ProctorU.
And so the student sits at their computer, but they have a webcam and somebody's watching them to make sure that no one's whispering answers to them or that they're not opening their book if they're not allowed to use their book and so on.
And they monitor what's on their screen, right, so that you don't Google the answer. So it's an interesting process because it allows us to check identity. So the proctors from this company ask you some questions from public databases about you, so be able to verify your identity. You have to show your ID, and then you start. They start the exam for you. If there are some issues with the exam, they can help you. Just, hey, it's not loading correctly, they can take a note or tell you. Or when there's some, what it's called, the misbehaving, the student's misbehaving, they're turning away, somebody came in or somebody's talking to them, they can actually record that. And then then that video is sent to a faculty member, and it's run through our academic integrity policy at the University of Arkansas.
Flexibility is one of the major benefits of enrolling in online courses. Gary Ferrier, Associate Dean for Undergraduate Programs in the Business College, says the online courses can be beneficial to traditional on-campus students who are studying abroad or who get called up for active duty. Online courses can also benefit students who are working or participating in an internship during the day by allowing them to take a class in their spare time. In addition to providing flexibility for students, Javier Reyes, Vice Provost for Distance Education, says the process of creating the courses has helped faculty members change the way they think about teaching.
Different departments will work differently, but what we do is once a faculty member is selected to be the one that creates this course, then we pair them up with an instructional designer and they go through a development process together. But it's the faculty of the University of Arkansas creating these courses. And in many departments, there's a lot of discussions about who should be the one that drives that process. You're actually talking to two of the economics faculties who have actually created online courses in the Department of Economics in the Walton College. So we went through the motion of working with instructional designers and really changing your understanding of how you're going to teach in this new modality for us. But for some of the students, it's a modality they know themselves.
It really makes you think a lot more about what you're doing. And everyone I've talked to and I would agree is that by going through this and having taught online, it makes you a better teacher, period, in any environment.
With the Bachelor of Science in Business Administration degree being offered completely online starting this fall, it's conceivable that a student may never step foot on campus until he or she arrives to participate in a graduation ceremony. However, Reyes says he wants online students to feel that they are part of the University of Arkansas.
So we're trying to make sure that they see them, the students online see themselves as part of the campus. They see themselves as Razorbacks. They identify with the University of Arkansas. And you were talking about what is the benefits that they can get as that other students on campus get. And it's, well, their names will be on Senior Walk. Those are students that their degree is recognized everywhere because it has the seal of the University of Arkansas. So that's the biggest benefit. We didn't want to have this degree or any online degree from the University of Arkansas to be seen as a separate degree. We want it to be part of the same ensemble that we have, part of the same ecosystem for the university. And we're trying to make sure that both students get some benefit because as we grow more online students, we may need more supplemental instruction. Well, those are students on campus that have scholarships to do those kinds of support systems. Well, we'll need more students like that. So there's a sort of a nice environment which if you grow more online, you'll need more face-to-face. So that's we're trying to make sure that it doesn't drive resources one way or another, but that it benefits both sides.
More information is available at online.uark.edu.
Just ahead on Ozark's More Online News, the fast-growing competitive world of parent blogging can also make money. Sarah Birmingham has that story next. And in about 12 minutes on Ozarks, from the Civil War to now, Cane Hill's story continues to be told.
The top floor of the rock had started to fall off, and so it was really in threat of falling in. And so we wanted to get that stabilized first. And some of these other buildings are the same way, but really the long-term project will involve more of that research on figuring out who individuals were. But it's really triage mode right now, and same with the next building that we're going to work on. I mean, it's 2 or 3 more years from now, and it won't be there.
Returning to Cane Hill, ahead on OAL.
Thank you so much, Zeke Taylor, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South.
I thought it was safe to have a little morning cocktail. I figured that the whiskey would calm my nerves, while the coffee would keep me somewhat sober. Every so often, I ventured into the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror, admiring my new look, while at the same time regretting my action.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
What some call mommy blogging is becoming a big business. What started as a cottage industry of parents posting pictures and stories about the challenges and charm of family life has become a portal for advertisers, marketers, and entrepreneurs. Only a handful of bloggers make enough money to give up their day job. A survey of mommy bloggers by online magazine Type A Parent found almost half make less than $250 per month from their posts. So how do Northwest Arkansan moms looking to monetize their content get paid? And can we still trust the stories, reviews, and advice those moms post online? Ozark's at-large's Sarah Birmingham has this report.
You flick through the Sunday papers and you see the adverts, the coupons. You see that slightly different typeface and something that doesn't quite look like the rest of the stories, and you squint and you see that it's an advertorial. But how does that work online? Here in Northwest Arkansas, home to the world's largest retailer and host to vendors who account for the biggest advertising dollars in the U.S. outside car manufacturing, a symbiotic relationship is growing up between PR agencies, advertisers, and what you might once have called mommy bloggers. Many prefer the term parent blogger, or simply blogger. The agencies that court them are in no doubt about what to call them. Influencers. A valuable new tool for advertisers to get us to do what advertisers have always wanted us to do, buy their client's product. Stephanie McCratic is one of those mommy bloggers. She started her blog, Evolved Mommy, in 2009 after moving to Northwest Arkansas from Little Rock. She says she now has 10,000 monthly unique viewers. Here's how she got started.
My husband said, why don't you start a blog? And I didn't really know what that meant, but I thought it sounded fabulous. So I started Evolved Mommy and got into a playgroup. And Evolved Mommy took this tech focus because my playgroup moms were asking me how to update their iPhones, how to justify an iPad, how to use a flip camera. And before I knew it, I was living in this small town, but this community had built up around me locally and nationally, and that was a really cool experience.
A recent survey by parent blogging magazine Type A Parent found only 1 in 4 parent bloggers make more than $500 per month. pay-per-click ad revenue is only really going to be a money spinner for bloggers with high traffic, say 300,000 unique views per month. According to Type A Parent Survey, the top revenue source for mommy bloggers is sponsored posts. Stephanie McCraddock says she had been blogging about a year when she received her first request to post sponsored content.
I was really flattered, but it wasn't a match. And so I knew that it was part of that I had achieved a certain level of influence, but they didn't really care about the relevance. And that kind of opened the floodgates. I got some pitches, and I continue to get pitches that almost feel gross because, you know, here's a quick $50 if you'll do X, Y, and Z. And a lot of times they'll ask for a blog post and so many social shares. And what a lot of agencies and brands don't realize is, one, I'm spending my social capital to do that, and I only have so much. And two, writing a blog post is actually a lot of work if you're going to do it right. And so you are asking me to take time away from my family and away from my passions to write about you for a dollar amount that does not meet what I'm putting in.
You may have noticed Collective Bias's current headquarters on South Main Street in Bentonville. But the agency is building new offices just off I-49, having outgrown the storefront space. Started in 2009, Collective Bias employs more than 100 people and has offices in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Toronto, Canada, and London, England. The company hosts a community of around 3,000 bloggers. They call themselves a shopper social media agency. Courtney Lawless, VP of Communities at Collective Bias, says bloggers work with them for a couple of reasons.
It's a sense of community. So you have your community that will help you share and like and give you support and answer questions. But then the other piece is they make money in this by being a part of Collective Bias. So they would apply for what we call shoppertunities. So a lot of other companies will send bloggers items to review through the mail. They get the item, they do a review, include the entire process. So we tie in the retailer, the product, and the experience. The opportunity might be go to Walmart, pick up the movie Disney Frozen, and what are you going to do with that movie to incorporate it into your life? And so they will go shopping for the item and whatever items they're going to do, maybe to put together a party. And then they will go home and then document that entire party process to their readers, tying, like I said, the retailer to the product to the experience.
Lawless says bloggers are paid anywhere between $125 to thousands of dollars for posting about these so-called shopportunities. She says mommy bloggers are attractive to advertisers because of their authenticity.
These are real people talking about real experiences. They're incorporating their families and their personal lives into things. They're taking pictures inside their home where you're seeing the pile of laundry or, you know, the fresh cut flower, whatever it is. And their children, they're opening their doors and saying, I'll photograph my child and show them to you. And you'll see the chocolate on the face or, you know, they're opening their doors into their homes. And I think that's what's really appealing to their followers. And it's appealing to the brands too.
So how do we pick out trustworthy content on blogs when so much of it has been paid for? The Federal Trade Commission introduced regulations in 2009 and updated them last year, targeting bloggers and sponsored content. Patsy Watkins is professor of journalism at the University of Arkansas, and she teaches ethics.
If they're receiving something free for a mention of a certain product, or if they're getting actually paid cash for mentioning a product, and then the third is an endorsement for an advertiser or a client, which they might do outside the context of blogging, but they might do it in some other form of social media, such as a Facebook mention or a Twitter mention. And so those are the three places where they're supposed to note where they're getting this material, compensation of some sort for these mentions. What is recommended by the FTC is that they have some sort of disclosure. And this disclosure can be as simple as saying in the blog post, oh, and I get such and such free diapers from so-and-so, but they are really good. You know, they just have to mention it, something like that. They don't have to have some sort of emblem that says disclosure.
Both Stephanie McCratick of Evolved Mommy and Courtney Lawless at Collective Bias started as bloggers and have spun their blogs into careers in social media marketing. And they both say that while it's nice to make money from your blog, maintaining credibility with your readers is of utmost importance. There's no point doing all the hard work of building a following, only to jeopardize it by endorsing the wrong products or saturating your feed with sponsored content. And it's certainly not going away. Old media bastions such as the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal now offer various kinds of sponsored content. And market research firm eMarketer predicts advertisers will be spending $3.2 billion per year on sponsored content by 2017. Sarah Birmingham, Ozarks at Large.
It is Tuesday, June 17th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
If you're not doing anything at noon tomorrow, and even if you are, you should cancel what you're doing and go to the Shiloh Museum in Springdale.
That's usually a very good recommendation from you.
It is their Sandwiched In monthly talk. Susan Young is speaking, and she's going
sold.
To talk.
I'm there.
Yeah, sold. And she's talking about Essie Ward.
Ooh.
Sold.
Yeah.
Okay, Essie Ward has been called the Grandma Moses of the Ozarks. She was born in the Searcy County community of Nubbin Hill in 1902. Mm-hmm. And she liked to draw, and she liked to paint, and she liked to sculpt.
And she painted and sculpted and drew what she saw.
Exactly. And since she was living on a small farm in a very rural area, raising chickens and hogs and vegetables and fruit trees and seven kids, it's very iconic representations of that time and that life. And it just happens that the Shiloh Museum has a whole big collection of her work.
If you've been there, you've seen them, at least part of the collection.
And the story's just fun because she ended up being recognized at the Smithsonian's Festival of American Folklife in Washington, D.C. in 1970. Sold hundreds of paintings, came up with a formula so she could paint the same scenes the way you wanted them. Mm-hmm. Oh, you want a blue barn? Okay, we can do that. Lived 79 years in Searcy County and died in 1981.
Yeah.
It will be a great talk, and they have cookies.
There you go.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Last fall, we visited historic Cane Hill for a tour of just a few of the 16 registered historic places in the small town. It's a town that runs along an 8-mile valley. At the time, the 501c3 historic Cane Hill had just been formed, and efforts were just being launched to save the significant markers of time. Ozarks at Large's Christina Karnatz recently revisited the town to check on the progress of the projects, and she brings us this report.
So, since you were here last, when you were here, this was a pretty rough-looking building. I think we walked in here briefly, so we're glad to have you back in Cane Hill.
That's Bobby Brawley, the director of Historic Cane Hill. He's standing in what was the A.R. Carroll Drugstore, a building constructed in 1900. The building was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1982. Cane Hill has a very rich history, which precedes the Civil War, though a battle was waged here. In the past, many efforts have been made to preserve that history, But it wasn't until an anonymous benefactor helped to hire Bobby and acquire this and other buildings that those efforts were realized. It is a slow process and one that is beginning with triage.
And we prioritized buildings based on A, their historic value, and B, their condition. And so this one was at the top of both of those lists. The top floor, the rock had started to fall off, and so it was really in threat of falling in. And so we wanted to get that stabilized first. And some of these other buildings are the same way, but really the long-term project will involve more of that research on figuring out who individuals were. But it's really triage mode right now, and same with the next building that we're going to work on. I mean, it's 2 or 3 more years from now, and it won't be there.
The next building will be the Methodist Manse. The square brick building was constructed in the 1830s and served as a Union building during the Civil War, before housing the preacher of the Methodist Church. Bobby knows little of A.R. Carroll at this time, but he does have this tidbit of information.
I know that he was a notary public. I've seen some stationery that says A.R. Carroll, notary public, so I guess people would come down here and get things notarized at one time or another, and don't know much else about him other than operating the general store here.
The former drugstore is the only remaining building of 3 identical rock two-story buildings on this stretch of Highway 45. At one point, there were about 16 buildings here. One was torn down. The other, the former Cane Hill Bank, has been significantly altered, with the second story having been removed. Bobby has heard that some of this rock was used on a building south of the Fayetteville Square, but has yet to make this connection. After housing the drugstore, this building has been home to many things. Most recently, a barbecue restaurant, and it was at one point the town's post office. The mail slot is still on the front of the building, to the left of the front door and near the ground. Jerry Leach is one of a 3-member board for Historic Cane Hill. He grew up in nearby Dutch Mills, moved away for about 35 years, but has returned to the area and now lives between Cane Hill and Lincoln.
And this building, I don't really remember it before it had an antique store in it. And I knew the people that ran the antique store here. So I was in here a few times at that time, but I probably didn't even realize it had been a drugstore.
The owners of the barbecue restaurant had covered up the original facade of the building with old barn wood. That's what I remember from my September visit, but it is long gone. So are over 15,000 pounds of trash that Bobby, volunteers, and workers remove from the space. The little things make all the difference, and even the doorknobs, locks, and hinges have been replaced with replicas of Victorian times. Not so little, the drugstore's shiny tin ceiling. Drop ceilings had been installed to cover the original and fantastic designs. Most of it was damaged. So what can now be seen is a replica, though some parts of the original have been salvaged for use elsewhere.
This is a reproduction in that it's a 4-piece or 4-part tin ceiling. So you have an 8-inch wall crown, a 2-foot filler piece, a piece of flat crown, and then the large area is called the field. And that's the exact same composition that the old ceiling was in here.
Local craftsmen were used whenever possible, though the ceilings came from one of just a couple of companies nationally that make the ceilings. It came with a 20-page manual for the local carpenters to install. Masons out of Prairie Grove worked on the exterior rock of the building. 3 of the 4 walls are now complete, but a scaffolding on the south side is still erect. Repairing the crumbling cement proved to be a learning experience for the craftsmen. Bobby says stabilizing the walls was #1 priority, yet it couldn't be done with any cement. He says the last thing you want to do is put modern mortar on old rock.
So this is old-time soft mortar that's been made specifically for this building. In fact, they dig local sands. They then sift that sand. They add in that to a big bucket of water. They give it a good stir, and that lets them pour off any of the clays, like decanting. And then they're able to mix that with lime putty, which is a derivative of quicklime. Once it's mixed with water and it's put in a pit for anywhere from 24 hours to several years, and it makes a white putty, and that's mixed with the sands, and so that replicates the mortar that's here.
The workers have to go in, clean out the old mortar that is cracking, and add in some of the new, which is a near-perfect match with the old. The upstairs of the 2-story building is accessed by a separate entrance in the rear, as it was a longtime meeting place of the Freemasons. Upon entering, they were met by a staircase, taking them up to their meeting space, where they met until as late as the mid-1980s. On this day, we were met by a sign from the workers.
Wet paint on stairs as of noon, so I guess we're gonna go for it.
The large room has a wood floor, wood ceiling, and wainscoting on the lower portion of the walls. On either end of the large room, the east and the west, there is a stage, which Bobby says are some of the only original building furniture, having been framed into the construction back in 1900. The hope in the very near future is to rent this bright and large room to artists as studio space. They would have ample room for their work, and it would couple nicely with a picture rail for display of their work that lines the walls of the downstairs room. As remodeling will soon begin at the Cane Hill College building, the A.G. Carroll Drugstore will soon be used as the Cane Hill Community Center. The museum that is also housed in the college will be moved to a building next door to the drugstore. Constructed in the 1950s, its history is not as long or rich, but the building is strong and suitable to house the memorabilia. And being directly on Highway 45 should increase accessibility. New sidewalks have been installed. And as the average age of Cane Hill is 65, ease of access is important. A house across the street was constructed in the 1880s and is now a private residence. It is also on the registry for historic places. When I met with Bobby last fall, he mentioned signage on these landmarks, and that's still a goal, though the triage must happen first. Again, Jerry Leach, who grew up here and now lives nearby.
A lot of people have seen things go downhill here, and there are buildings here, and with the history behind them, it's worth preserving. And I think it will be a big draw to this area. There will be interest in Cane Hill with all the historical background from before the Civil War on up to the present.
The response has been good, with many locals asking questions as work begins and continues in Cane Hill. In association with Arkansas Heritage Month in May, a celebration was held at the drugstore and over 200 people attended. And in September, the annual Cane Hill Harvest Festival will take place here as well. For more information on these restoration efforts, search Historic Cane Hill on Facebook. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Karnatz.
The 21st Annual Cancer Challenge approaches. The multifaceted fundraiser gets underway in earnest Thursday with a tennis tournament and trap shooting in Bella Vista. Then Friday, the golf tournament also in Bella Vista, and Saturday a 5K and 10K, as well as a one-mile fun run or walk at Orchards Park in Bentonville. You can see the entire schedule at cancerchallenge.com. The money raised at all of the events, including Saturday's Summer Nights Gala in Gravette, is directed toward cancer care for people in Northwest Arkansas.
Right now, you can pick up a copy of this month's sci-fi reading selection at the Van Buren Public Library. The selection this month is the graphic novel Serenity, Those Left Behind by Joss Whedon. He's the creator of the Buffy the Vampire television series and director of Marvel's Avengers. A discussion of the book will take place at the Van Buren Library Saturday afternoon at 3. You can learn more by calling 474-6045.
Friday and Saturday nights, a true musical legend will be at the Fayetteville Underground on the Fayetteville Square and the Eureka House in Eureka Springs. Bob Livingston was a founding member of the iconic Lost Gonzo Band, and his latest CD, Gypsy Alibi, received Album of the Year honors at the Texas Music Awards. His concert in Fayetteville is Friday night at 7:30 at the Underground, and he plays Saturday night at 6:30 at the Eureka House. For more, you can go to texasmusic.org.
And finally, if you like food and competition and trout fishing in America, Saturday's Celebrity Chef Throwdown may be your best bet for the weekend. Chefs from Greenhouse Grill, River Grill, and Tuscan Trotter will participate in a 60-minute competition at Magnolia Gardens in Springdale. The event is a fundraiser for Ronald McDonald House Charities of Arkoma. Tickets are $50 for adults, children 12 and under, admitted free. There will also be ice sculpting and a kids' play area. The event is from 2 until 5. You can find out more at rmhcofarkoma.org.
Every day when I open my eyes now, I'm Jeremy Hobson. British singer-songwriter David Gray is out with a new album, but why is his music so melancholy?
I don't know what my beef is exactly with existence, but somehow when I'm singing, it's like it comes out in this way.
A conversation and performance from David Gray next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
NPR's Here and Now this afternoon from 1 to 3 on KUAF.
The Yellow Jackets are one of the longest-running contemporary jazz bands. Their formation stretches back to the late 70s, and their first album, self-titled, was released in 1981. Since, there have been more than 20 additional recordings, 2 Grammy Awards, and at least 4 Grammy nominations in each decade, the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And when the band tours, and their latest tour brings them to Eureka Springs this month, it is not a rest-on-your-laurels sort of experience.
We're going to be hungry because we haven't played a lot recently. We've had some breaks this year, and we're always hungry to play.
Felix Pistorius is the newest addition to the Yellow Jackets. The bassist replaces founding member Jimmy Haslip, who left to spend more time at home. Felix is exactly 1 year younger than the legendary band he's joined. This week, he told me his inclusion in one of the most beloved bands in the world is still a bit hard to fathom.
You know, I've had this question a few times, and I don't know if I've ever nailed it right. It's shocking. It's something that I'm obviously grateful for, but you never know how to handle something. I mean, that it's a name that's synonymous with jazz, the jazz fusion that has been around since, you know, obviously, as you stated, before I was born. So I've known the name Yellow Jackets for quite some time. So to be associated with it, especially in a situation where I'm playing a part that someone else whose individual name outside of the Yellow Jackets is also synonymous with jazz and fusion and now electric bass. It's surreal and it's shocking at first. And it was something that, you know, almost most situations that are going to hopefully be a proving ground for myself personally, it's always something where I doubt if it's anything I'm even possible of doing. But I'm always grateful because obviously there's at least a handful of people or a couple of people who believe that I can add to it.
The Yellow Jackets' latest CD is A Rise in the Road, proving the band's dedicated audience is still in lockstep with them. The album debuted at number 1 on iTunes Jazz Chart. On that recording, Felix Pistorius' bass meshes easily with the 3 veterans of the band, founder and keyboardist Russell Ferrante, saxophonist Bob Mincer, and drummer William Kennedy. Combined, those 3 guys have 68 years with the Yellow Jackets. Felix says if his playing on A Rise in the Road sounds comfortable, then his trick worked.
Because I was far from comfortable being in the studio. And it's not because of necessarily even who I was playing with or the material. It's mostly because recording chops are a different set of chops, I believe. I believe every situation for a musician is different. So whether it be, practicing chops is different than gigging chops, is different than rehearsal chops, is different than recording. So I up until recording the last album with the Jackets, I had spent very little time compared to how much time I'd spend on my bass practicing on playing gigs, spent very, very, very little time in the studio.
If the chops are different, is the mental approach different to each of those?
I would say so, absolutely. It's a different role. It's a different responsibility. Not greatly different because each individual instrument has a role specific to itself, but in terms of in terms of execution, in terms of interpreting what needs to happen and recording is it's a lifelong statement. It's something that once everybody says, okay, that's the tape, then that's it. And not that it will be judged, critiqued every single second, every day for the rest of time, but it is, it's recorded. So you approach things differently, and you want to, definitely be supportive and but at the same time find the balance in between supporting and nudging and being a part of something, magical that's happening, which is mostly what live music is all about, which people hope to catch in a live situation, is the magic that happens in between the communicating between musicians. And to have that transcend over into recording, it is not always the simplest or the easiest, and I think that's what a lot of people chase.
Felix Pastor sounds at home in the studio, but he says he thrives when he's on stage. He's honed his live performances with the all-star ensemble Mutet. That band includes Felix and members of Bela Fleck and Dave Matthews bands. He has a regular Monday gig at New York City's Zinc Bar with his band, the Hipster Assassins. And, he says, he also simply gets better just by teaching.
Absolutely. Every time I teach, anytime anything is reiterated, and, it's every time you recite the ABCs, I believe you get better at it, to put it that way. So, you ingrain it that much more into your psyche, into your playing, becomes that much more of a muscle memory. Or you look at it differently again, or you realize something that was in plain view all this time, and only because you've progressed so far, now it makes way more sense, or you see it differently, or, there's a handful of things. So I definitely appreciate it. And especially, musicians and artists who make the effort to step out and learn something new, that's the number one thing is the initiative. I've said before, it's not the teacher. All the teacher can do is, give directions to get to a certain point. It's up to the student to step on the gas.
Felix Pastorius will perform with the Yellow Jackets, one of the most decorated contemporary jazz bands in history, at the City Auditorium in Eureka Springs, June 21st. The concert is the opener in the 16th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. A link to tickets and information can be found at KUAF.com.
The rivers are flowing after the spring rains, and canoeists and kayakers are coming in droves. Music tourists are descending on the area, too, with the just-completed Wakarusa Music Festival and the Eureka Blues Weekend. The state's tourism leaders are luring another kind of tourist to come to the natural state, motorcyclists. Already, thousands hit Northwest Arkansas in the fall for bikes, blues, and barbecue. But Arkansas is now touting its scenic highways as year-round two-wheeled destinations. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics has this report.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure in whatever comes our way.
The Ultimate Biker Song could serve as a marketing campaign for a new push from state tourism officials. In the last 2 years, Arkansas has begun marketing its scenic highways to motorcyclists, who are far from the drifter image painted in cult classic films like Easy Rider. We're not talking Hell's Angels, says Arkansas Tourism Director Joe David Rice.
These are not the motorcyclists that their mom has warned them about. These are basically, as Willie Nelson would say, doctors and lawyers and such.
Earlier this year, and for the first time ever, Arkansas's Parks and Tourism Department published the Arkansas Motorcycle Guide and has already fielded requests from nearly 4,000 people for the resource book. The guide lists 21 routes for riders, dates and locations for motorcycle rallies across the state, sightseeing opportunities in different regions, and of course, hospitality stops along the Arkansas roadways. Roughly 29% of the requests for the guide have been from in-state inquiries. That number rises to about 45% when you add in the surrounding states of Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana. All told, requests have been received from 48 states, and the District of Columbia for the Arkansas Motorcycle Guide.
We think motorcycles present a great opportunity for us. No other state's really targeting them right now. They're riding expensive motorcycles. They're staying at bed and breakfast resorts, hotels, and they love Arkansas. They'll come here 10 months a year.
Rice said motorcycle enthusiasts typically skew older. They travel in pairs or larger groups and tend to be financially affluent. Statistics compiled by a 2010 Caesars Hospitality Research Summit of bikers aged 50 or older showed that 59% are male. Roughly 25% reported incomes of $30,000 to $50,000 a year, and another 22% earned $50,000 to $70,000 annually. About 37% of motorcycle enthusiasts surveyed were retired or self-employed. Another 27% were listed as professionals, 17% were craftsmen, and 11% had a background in the military or public sector. They also spend $50 or more on shopping and souvenirs on day trips. Rice said that native Arkansas hospitality and the state's natural beauty are a good combo for motorcycle recruiting. He also said a policy change made a few years ago has also endeared the state as an attraction for bikers.
We got friendly people, we got some really good motorcycle routes, and we don't have a helmet law.
MotorcycleRoads.com ranked its top 100 U.S. routes, and Arkansas has 7 roads on the list. The highest ranking is the Arkansas Pig Trail, Highway 23, which comes in at number 9 on the top 100 list. Born to be wild.
That story provided by Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business and Politics. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large provided in part by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Pea Ridge.
You went 3-0 in soccer yesterday.
I don't know that I went 3-0.
But you gathered with many others to watch the U.S.-Ghana game in the World Cup?
I did. I started out at Smoke and Barrel because that's where the American Outlaws kind of official, I think, meet is. That's the local chapter of the fan club for the men's U.S. soccer team. But it was completely packed. I don't know how they got so many people in there. It's quite impressive. So opted to go down the street to Grubbs and sit.
And there were people there?
Oh, it was also crowded, but I could sit instead of stand. So
it wasn't that long ago that there would be a U.S. World Cup match on and it wouldn't get that much attention. Mm-hmm. This has developed over the last
It was really great to see so many people come out, and everybody was excited, of course, when they won and all that good stuff. So, yeah, it was really fun to watch it with a big group of people.
And then you played soccer last night.
I did. I did. Yes, our team won our 2 games in our tournament, so we advanced to today's game. So,
all right. And the Americans next play Portugal Sunday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Will you gather with people again? Or
absolutely.
Very good. All right. Have I mentioned the Kansas City Royals have won 8 in a row?
You have not, but another avid Royals fan has.
I know who that is, yes. All right. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
My name is Monica Hayda.
We're going to end today's show with the Rowe Family Singers. They are self-described as a good old-time hillbilly band from Kirkwood Hollow, Minnesota. One of their CDs is titled Heaven, Send Us Better Times, and that's where you can hear this version of Keep on the Sunny Side. They'll be at Smoke and Barrel in downtown Fayetteville tomorrow night. Thanks so much for listening.